So Job chapter 2, verse 11. So far what's happened is Job's been through all these sufferings. He's lost everything. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. They made an appointment together to come to show him sympathy and comfort him. And when they saw him from a distance, they didn't recognize him. And they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads towards heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived, let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning. Because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, or why the breasts that I should nurse? For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept. Then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not as a hidden stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? There the wicked cease from the troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes instead of my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. For the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes." St. Nick's is an evangelical church like the Barge. It's over in the city. And one of the associate ministers there, so basically doing Callum's job, is a young guy called Mikey Williams. And at the beginning of this month, he was admitted to hospital because he'd been feeling unwell for a few weeks. He'd had headaches, he'd had vomiting. And investigations revealed that he has got the worst type of brain tumour, and there is nothing they can do. They gave him hours to live. This was a few weeks ago, and he's still alive, but no one knows how long he's got. He's just been moved to a hospice. And when he dies, he will leave behind his wife, Alyssa, and their two young children. It's hard, isn't it, to imagine yourself in that situation? But have a go. Have a go. How would it feel, do you think? What emotions would you be experiencing? Do you think as a believer you would be asking the question, why? How dark do you think things might at times get for you? So does being a believer, being a follower of Jesus, does it mean that despite everything, you'd just be overflowing with hope, overflowing with joy? What will it be like for this young family in 6 months' time? How will they feel then? These are really important questions for us to consider, because at some point as believers, we ourselves are going to suffer, if we haven't already. And we need to be prepared for how that may feel and how difficult that may be. And we will know other believers who are suffering, And we need to be aware of how they might be feeling if we are going to help them and comfort them. Well, the book of Job is all about a suffering believer. He loses, as we've seen so far, he loses everything. He loses his possessions, his servants, his children, and his health. And he loses all this stuff not because he's sinned in some way and he's being punished, not because of that, but because the devil accuses him before God of being a fair-weather believer. And so God allows these severe trials to test his faith and to show him to be a genuine all-weather believer. And Job passes the test with flying colors. He holds firm his faith. He doesn't curse God. And in spite of everything, he says, "Blessed be the name of the Lord." That's where we've got to so far in the book of Job. It's remarkable. But that is not the end of the story. So although Job doesn't turn against God, he does go through very, very dark days. Very dark days. And here in chapter 3 that I've just read, he laments, he grieves, he questions, and he's in a very, very dark place emotionally and mentally, but he is still a believer. And it's so important we see this, that the true believer may go through times when everything feels dark, everything feels hopeless. Now, this isn't prescriptive. That is, it's not saying that we should or we must feel like this. It isn't prescriptive. It's descriptive. So it's saying this is how one godly believer felt. And although we are unlikely to experience the extreme suffering that Job did, losing absolutely everything, it's still how we may feel at some point, or it's how other believers may feel. I mean, after all, it's not just circumstances that can cause such feelings. This passage describes the loneliness of suffering and the darkness of suffering. So firstly, on the inside of your service sheets, the loneliness of suffering. Suffering can be a lonely business. Where is Job when today's passage begins? Well, just before this, in chapter 2, verse 8, we had this last time we were in Job. 2, verse 8, it said this. He took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. So Job is covered with these terrible sores, and he is sitting in the ashes. And that refers to the rubbish tip outside town, beyond the city walls, where the refuse is continually burned. That's where he's sitting. Now, it may be that the community sent him away there because they were afraid he was going to infect others with his terrible sores. But, you know, anyway, there he is. He's in quarantine on this rubbish tip outside town, all alone. All alone. The one human relationship he had left was with his wife. But we saw last time we were in Job, they had this falling out. They had this big disagreement. She's now off the scene, as far as we can tell. And so he's totally isolated. He's this lonely sufferer sitting on the rubbish tip. And a bit later in chapter 7, verse 3, he'll say, "I'm allotted months of emptiness and nights of misery." Suffering can be a very lonely business. And it's important that we recognize this dimension of suffering. That the challenge is not just coping with maybe physical pain or grief. One of the hardest things can be loneliness. When you're ill, it cuts you off, doesn't it, from other people? So maybe you're in bed, sick, at home, and life goes on around you, but without you. You hear the noise out in the streets as the world carries on. You hear the laughter in the room next door, but you're alone in bed. And maybe some of you had a taste of this, this kind of isolation, if you had COVID and were quarantined. Being in hospital, I don't know if any of you have been in hospital, but it can be a very lonely experience. Visitors come and go, but most of the time, Most of the time you're alone in a place full of strangers. And it feels like you've entered a parallel universe where life is on hold and you spend forever waiting. You're waiting for the next ward round. You're waiting to get better. You're waiting for results. And the hours just sort of tick by, don't they? Very, very slowly. Bereavement is a lonely trial. You lose a child, you lose a spouse, you lose parents, and you can feel very alone in the world. And nobody else really knows what it's like. So loss, people say, loss is uniquely experienced by you. So even parents who have lost a child will experience that loss in a different way. So being a mum, being a dad, is a different relationship. And so you can feel very alone, even when the loss is shared. I was reading a book this past week called Tears and Tossings. It's a book by Sarah Walton, and it's about her experience of suffering. She had chronic health issues. She had a special needs child. She had no income. She had lost her home. And then she discovered that in pregnancy, she had passed on her condition to her four children. Well, there are 9 chapters in the book, and each one explores a different aspect of suffering, grief and loss, hopelessness, pain, fear, shame. But the first chapter is on loneliness. She writes, "Worst of all, I was enveloped in an overwhelming sense of loneliness. Loneliness comes in all shapes and forms. At times, physical illness or a special needs child. It prevents us from typical life activities. It forces us into isolation. At other times," she says, "we experience a loss or a trial to which very few can relate. At such times, we need friends, don't we? We need friends who can come alongside us." So verse 11 says, "Now, when Job's 3 friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they each came from his place. Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar. They made an appointment together to come to him to show sympathy and to comfort him." When you come across the term friend in the Bible, it's a really strong word. It speaks of covenant loyalty, of steadfast love, of commitment. So it's not Facebook friends, it's real friends. Now that is what we need. And Job had 3 such friends. What did they do? They took time. They took effort. They arranged to come and see him. They made the journey. And their intention was what? Well, we read there in verse 11, their intention was to show him sympathy. That is to enter into his pain and grief. And their intention was to comfort him. That is to find a way to ease his pain. Now, as we'll see next week, they failed miserably. But their intention was good. Their intention was good. One of the great friendships in the Bible was that of David and Jonathan. I don't know if you know the story, but in 1 Samuel 23, verse 16, David was at a time in his life when he was on the run from Saul, who was trying to kill him. Desperate times. But his friend Jonathan went to David, and it said, he strengthened his hand in God. That is true comfort, isn't it? Coming alongside a suffering friend and giving them strength to carry on. Job's friends, they rightly acknowledge how terrible his situation is. In verse 12, it says, when they saw him from a distance, they didn't recognize him. You may have had that experience that sometimes when a loved one is ill, we can be shocked, can't we, by how their appearance is changed by the illness. Remember when my mother-in-law was undergoing cancer treatment and her face was so puffed up with steroids, she was almost unrecognizable. Same with Job. And verse 12 says, they raised their voices, they wept, they tore their robes, and they sprinkled dust on their heads towards heaven. Mourning, they're signs of mourning. They mourn with him. And that's important. They don't make out all is fine when it's not. They don't try and make light of it and crack jokes. They don't say, well, Job, you know, things could be worse. Let's be positive. They weep and they mourn with him. And verse 13 says, they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. Sometimes we're tempted, aren't we, to avoid someone who is suffering because we don't know what to say. But we don't have to say anything. Sometimes what the person needs is for you just to be with them, to sit with them at what's called the power of presence. And perhaps sometimes just touch rather than words. So the evangelist Roger Carswell, who we watched on video there, he writes of a time when he was very low, and he says, I remember how on one occasion my son simply put his arm around me when he found me crying in my study. And he says it was a moment of great comfort to me. Being hugged, he says, is part of being healed. Being hugged is part of being healed. Now that said, sitting with Job in silence for 7 days and nights is pretty extreme, isn't it? Must have got a bit awkward after a while. And it maybe highlights that these friends actually had nothing useful to say, as we'll see next week. Anyway, three implications I put on the sheet from this. First, if you are a suffering believer, recognize that you need friends who will show you sympathy and comfort. But to receive that, we have to be honest, don't we, about the suffering that we're going through and what our need is. So not just saying everything is fine when it's not. It's been said that that word fine is actually an acronym which stands for feelings inside not expressed. Saying how we really feel, it may be very difficult for some of us to do. Maybe for personal reasons, maybe for cultural reasons, to admit, I need help, I need friendship, I need support. Secondly, we need to be good friends to other believers who are suffering. We need, as Romans 12:15 says, to weep with those who weep. Who are you such a friend to? Who are you such a friend to? It can be hard, can't it? There is a cost to being such a friend to someone who is suffering. So being with someone who is suffering can be draining. But this is part of love, isn't it? This is part of what looking left looks like on the barge vision diagram. And we need to be aware the temptation to just hang out with people who are positive and healthy and happy because they make me feel good and they give me something back. We need to beware that. And third, ultimately, this lonely sufferer and his friends, they point us to Jesus. Job's lonely suffering foreshadows that of Jesus. So Jesus, too, was a blameless believer who suffered terribly. And in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was there with his three closest friends. But they fell asleep. They left him all alone. And when he was arrested, they all deserted him. And on the cross, he suffered alone. He was forsaken even by God. Are you a lonely sufferer? Well, Jesus knows what that is like. He can sympathize. He's been there. And because he suffered for us, he can now be with us by his Spirit in our lonely sorrow. And he is the ultimate friend we need, the friend who comes alongside us, who walks with us in the darkness. As one hymn says, what a friend we have in Jesus, all our sins and griefs to bear. But that does not magically make everything okay. So another hymn says, days of darkness still come over me, sorrow's paths I often tread. And that was definitely the case for Job, as we see here in chapter 3. We turn from the loneliness of suffering to the darkness. This is a dark chapter, isn't it? It's the darkest in the book. Job is speaking here, but he's not speaking to anyone in particular. He's not speaking to his friends. He's not speaking to God. He's just expressing how he feels. And the poetry here, it is poetry, is full of intense and powerful emotions. Now, if we just had Job chapters 1 and 2 that we've looked at so far in previous weeks, we would have the impression that although Job suffered terribly, he took it on the chin and he just trusted God was in control. That's the kind of impression we have so far from 1:21 and 2:10. But that is not the whole story. In chapter 3 here, the lights go out and Job is in a very, very dark place. So if you look at 3:1, it says, "After this, Job opened his mouth and he cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, 'Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived.'" In verses 4 and 5, he curses the day he was born. Verse 4, he says, "Let that day be darkness." Verse 5, he says, "Let gloom and deep darkness claim it." And these words for darkness just pile up and up and up. I mean, a birth is normally an occasion for celebration, for joy. So much so that we celebrate our birthday on that date every year, don't we? We celebrate. But Job wishes that the day of his birth had never happened. And then in verses 6 to 10, he even curses the night that he was conceived. Verse 6, he says, "That night let thick darkness seize it." Job wishes it had never happened. He wants that day, he says, erased from the calendar. He wishes his mother's womb had stayed barren. Verse 7, "Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it." Presumably the cry of his parents making love. Conception, birth, usually so full of joy, so full of hope. But Job just sees them as being the cause of his present misery. And so he curses them. Now remember who is saying this. This is Job. This is a man whom God affirmed in chapter 1, verse 8, chapter 2, verse 4, as a blameless man, God's servant. God said there was no one like him on earth. And right at the end of the book, God affirms again that Job is his servant. And God does not rebuke him, doesn't tell him off. He doesn't say he's wrong for feeling this way. God does not say that this is an ungodly response to suffering. This tells us that if we walk closely with the Lord, we may go through times of deep darkness, times of despair, times of depression, times when, like Job, the future feels empty of hope and we're just looking back with regret. Now, even though we've not fallen into sin, even though we haven't backslidden, a true believer may experience times of deep darkness and despair. We had that, didn't we, in our first reading, Psalm 88, the very darkest of psalms. You have it with Elijah, that experience after Mount Carmel. Very similar. Now, someone might say, well, this is just the Old Testament, isn't it? And it's different now. It's different. You know, we live after the resurrection of Jesus, and we've got a clearer eternal hope, and we've got the gift of the Holy Spirit. I think the answer is yes, we do. But the darkness may at times feel just as deep. Think of Jesus in Gethsemane, and there are plenty of examples of this in church history. There was a great and godly 19th century Baptist preacher called Charles Spurgeon, who is based down at by the Elephant Castle, the Met Tab. Really influential, the first guy with a sort of mega church, thousands of people went to his church. He suffered from terrible depression throughout his life. He said in one sermon, "I'm the subject of depressions of spirit so fearful that I hope none of you ever get to such extremes of wretchedness as I go to." So if you experience this as a believer, don't feel guilty. Don't feel guilty. One Christian book about depression, the title is, "I'm Not Supposed to Feel Like This." I'm not supposed to. We can feel guilty, can't we, if we're going through times like that? But we don't need to. Job was one of the three most righteous men in the Old Testament. So don't feel ashamed if you go through times like this. and do not look down on a fellow believer who experiences such darkness as if, well, they must have done something wrong. Instead, if we've never been through this kind of stuff ourselves, we should let this chapter teach us how life can look for another believer, and it will help us sympathize. This chapter also should make us beware a certain type of Christianity. There is a shallow, superficial, sometimes called happy-clappy type of Christianity, which makes out that if we're true believers, we should always be smiling and happy and laughing and full of the joys of spring. It's the kind of Christianity that would have had Jesus skipping around and singing choruses at the grave of Lazarus. There's one modern song about Jesus' victory which says this. It has the line, "In his presence, our problems disappear." If you know that song, if you've even sung it, "In his presence, our problems disappear." But they don't, do they? It's just not true. Faith in God does not mean our problems magically disappear or just become insignificant and trivial. It's not a question of, well, have faith in God and everything's going to be fine. That kind of easy triumphalism is neither true to the Bible nor true to life. From verse 11, things get even darker as Job wishes he were dead. Verse 11, he says, "Why did I not die at birth, come out of the womb, and expire? Why did the knees receive me? Or why the breasts that I should nurse?" So he's thinking back there to when he was a baby. He was on his mother's knee. He was breastfeeding. But he wishes, he says, it had never happened. He thinks that death would have been better because death, he thinks, would have meant rest instead of the suffering he's now going through. So you look at verse 13. He says, "For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept. Then I would have been at rest." It's really bleak stuff, isn't it? In verses 14 to 19, he sees the place of the dead as a place where powerful oppressors end up, kings and princes, and also where the oppressed find rest from their troubles. So verse 17, "There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest." You see, this is why he sees the grave as being preferable to life in this world. He says, you know, people can't oppress you there anymore. It's an end to your suffering. And then the last bit, 20 to 26, the longing for death becomes even more explicit. So verse 20, he says, "Why is light given to him who is in misery and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death, but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures?" He doesn't want to carry on living. He's obsessed with death as the only way out, and not in the sense of, you know, I desire to depart and be with Christ, that's far better. Not in that sense, but in the sense of, I've had enough. I've had enough of life, I don't want to carry on. He cannot see the point of life anymore. Twice he says, "Why is light given?" He's saying, you know, what is the point of life when it's so miserable? He ends up in verse 26 with these four statements about his lack of rest, lack of peace. He says, "I'm not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes." Well, what should we take home from this? I put three things finally on the sheet. Firstly, like Job, a true godly believer may experience times of such darkness, such depression, that they don't want to go on living. They want to die. Charles Spurgeon, the pastor I mentioned, he could relate to this desire to end it all. He said, "I could readily enough have laid violent hands upon myself to escape from my misery." Evangelist Roger Carswell, who was in the interview, godly man, strong faith, we've had him speak at the Barge numerous times. At a time of deep depression, and he alluded to it in the interview, he came very, very close to taking his own life. He writes this. He says, sorry, do you want to just deal with that? So at one point he came very close to taking his life. And he writes this. He says, "Thoughts of dying dominated my mind. There was a craving for death. I planned a suicide that I was sure would be recorded as accidental death. I cannot tell you how near I was to taking my own life, but I refrained from doing so because I felt it would scar the life of my wife and children until their dying day. Perversely, he says, minutes before the dreadful moment of death, I was sharing the gospel with an unsaved man and longing that he would trust Christ as Lord and Savior. Suicide is not the unforgivable sin. It is not the unforgivable sin. So a true believer who takes their own life is still saved. They don't go to hell. The only unforgivable sin is not trusting in Jesus and turning away from him. But suicide is still wrong. It is self-murder, and it is unloving to those that you leave behind. So if you ever find yourself contemplating suicide, do not do it. Get help. Reach out to someone. Reach out to a Christian friend. Come and speak to a member of staff. Second take home is it is okay to ask why questions. Job cries out why. How many times in these verses? I think I counted five. So verse 11, verse 12, verse 16, verse 20, verse 23. It is not inappropriate to cry out why. It's not a sign that you lack faith that you're asking the why questions. Job still believes in God. So in verse 23, he sees himself as someone whom God has hedged in, the God who gives light and life. He still believes in God. It is precisely because he believes in God and because he knows God is sovereign that he's struggling so much and he's questioning so much. Because he's saying, why would God allow him to experience this suffering? So, if you're a believer and you're asking the why questions, don't feel ashamed. Don't sort of keep it quiet. Share them. Share your questions with a believing friend or a member of staff so we can walk with you through it. And then the final take home, again, is to look to Jesus, the ultimate blameless sufferer. The darkness that Job experienced foreshadows the even deeper darkness that Jesus endured. Do you remember the darkness in the Garden of Gethsemane? I mean, literally it was dark because it was at night, but also the darkness of Jesus being overwhelmed with sorrow, sweating blood, it says in the account. And then the darkness the next day on the cross. Again, the literal physical darkness that covered the land at midday. But then the spiritual darkness as well. As Jesus cried out, my God, why? The why question, why have you forsaken me? Now, he experienced that darkness for us to rescue us from a life which is now truly without hope, and to rescue us from the eternal darkness that lies ahead, a place where there is no hope and no light and only regret. And now risen from the dead, he promises that he'll be with us now by his Spirit. He promises he'll never leave us or forsake us. He promises that he will walk with us through dark times. As the words of an old hymn puts it, days of darkness still may meet me, sorrow's path I oft may tread, but his presence still is with me, and by his guiding hand I'm led.